Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the High Percentage Podcast. I hope you all had a good week and are ready to get back out there and start training again. Tournament season is coming up, although I understand that nowadays, if you want, tournament season doesn't really have to end. But, you know, the fall season, some of the big heavy hitters are coming around, and I hope we're all sort of getting ready for that. Or maybe if you're going to start competing, you're ready to jump in and dive in. I know myself, I'm probably going to do a couple in the next couple months, including some IBJJF ones, but also some kind of submission-only ones. And I haven't competed in a little while, so I'm looking forward to getting back in there and working my way back up to, you know, competition shape. I wanted to talk today about the game theory concept of endgame positions and how we can use sort of the theory of the endgame in our Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu training and when it's appropriate to do that, but when it might not be appropriate to do that. And this came up recently because I typically have been sort of a submission-only sort of player, and some of the competitions I've done have had that rule set, but some of the upcoming ones that I'm going to do are IBJJF tournaments, and even if I do them no-gi, which I probably will because that's what I've been doing lately, it does require sort of a shift in strategy. So it's got me thinking about how you have to shift away from endgame positions in some cases. And I thought that'd be a great topic to sort of think about and talk about today. Endgame is a term that we get from the game of chess, and it refers to the last several moves in a chess game when there are probably only a few pieces left on the board, including the kings, and it's just what it sounds like. You're sort of down to the final steps. A lot of times victory is basically assured once you get to the endgame point. It's just a matter of how long someone can kind of draw it out. And there's a lot of parallels to that in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I think. When I trained in 10th Planet, we had something that we called like the death zones, which is that it's a position that if you get someone in it, it's considered a death zone because I don't know what the criteria was, but I think it was like if you have like three or more submission options from a given position, then, you know, it's like a death zone, which means that you really should finish someone from there. Of course, anything can happen, but you know, there's this huge mismatch in terms of your offensive potential versus their offensive potential. Taking someone's back would be a great example of a death zone, which is you have a lot of attack options. They really don't have any attack options. They have sort of defense and escape options, aside from like the really kind of novel submissions. In submission grappling, there are many endgame positions, and a lot of them are the really obvious ones that we think all the time, the back or the top of mount. But there are other ones that could be kind of specific to you and your game, like the Ashigarami or even like the bottom of the half guard. Something that was a really interesting endgame experiment, and actually it's where the worlds of chess and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu sort of merged, was there's a YouTube video online of a guy named Tim Ferriss, and he's a very popular author. He wrote the 4-Hour Workweek, and he did a experiment put on his YouTube channel where he learns Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, or like he had 1 week to train and learn Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and he did it at the Marcelo Garcia Academy under the tutelage of, let me find this guy's name real quick. It was Josh Waitsky, and he actually is a chess master and was a chess prodigy in his younger days. In fact, Josh Waitsky was the inspiration for the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer, which was a fun movie about chess that they made in the 90s. Anyways, so it was a simple experiment. You have a week to learn what you can of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and then at the end of that week, we're going to put you in a competition scenario. I think they put him against another Marcelo Garcia purple belt. And what Josh, the instructor, did, which was really brilliant and a great sort of game theory solution, was he said, okay, all we're going to do is we're going to teach you the guillotine. We're going to teach you the end game positions in which the guillotine is very likely. And that's it. We're not going to teach you any submission defense. We're not going to teach you how to pass guard. We're only going to focus on the end game position that gets you to the guillotine. And the end game position that gets you the guillotine is typically the guard, which is a smart idea because it's very easy, relatively easy to get into the close guard as opposed to, you know, if you would have focused on the collar choke from the mount or some sort of back take position. That requires a lot of prerequisites to get there. but instead he chose something that was very obtainable. And for a week, they did a lot of private lessons, and they just had this sort of kamikaze approach, which is, hey, this guy's either going to jump on him, get the guillotine, or he's going to get beaten very, very quickly. And really, that sort of reckless approach is probably the only real option when you have a week to learn something as big and as broad as Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Another thing I appreciate about Josh's approach was that he approached the problem with the understanding that the win condition for this experiment was that his student had to submit someone with a week of training. It wasn't enough just to be defensive and not get tapped out, although that probably would have been like a moral victory to not get tapped out by a purple belt with just a week of training. But he wisely recognized the game theory behind Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is not unlike the game theory behind chess. We have a whole other podcast about this. But in the sense that in chess, you can't not lose. You have to win. Otherwise, it's a draw, and a draw is essentially the same as a loss. And in competition BJJ, it's much the same, which is you have to win on points or you have to submit your opponent. If you can't do either of those things, by default, you're going to lose. Now, I actually think that the Tim Ferriss experiment is not really a terrible way to think of your entire offensive game, which is to have it revolving around an endgame position. Now, Josh did a modified version of this, which is he focused specifically on the submission, and he chose a good submission because they were doing, I think, all no-gi grappling, if I remember correctly, and we know from our statistics that we've run that the guillotine is a very, very good submission for no-gi grappling, and as opposed to the rear naked choke, which is the top one, the guillotine is so much more accessible. Now, when we talk about endgame positions in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, the strength of them is that when you're in an endgame position, like the back, you have multiple submission options. So you don't need to hunt one particular submission. You have enough that you can kind of chain attack that you should be winning once you get to that endgame position. This phenomenon of discovering endgame positions is something that a lot of us go through in our Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu journey. An example for myself was that when I was a white belt, I was very well-rounded, and I learned a little bit about all the positions, and I could kind of hunt submissions from time to time when I found myself in a strong position. But like many students, after I became a blue belt, I started discovering positions that I really enjoyed. And because I really enjoyed them, I got better at them. And for me, that first position that I started specializing in was the bottom of half guard. And it got to a point where I just knew that if I could get to the bottom of someone's half guard, I probably could sweep or submit them. And I was focusing, you know, a disproportionate amount of my time in that position. And it was really the first endgame position that I really started to enjoy. And then, of course, as, you know, the journey goes on, you start discovering other things and new positions that you like. But the real strength of endgame positions is that they give your game a sort of direction, which is that there was a time in my training when I would start a roll and I never really had any particular plan or idea of where I wanted to go. A lot of it could be determined by just the natural flow of a roll or what my opponent did. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, because I think when we're training kind of casually, having that openness of like, let's just see where the roll takes us, that can be a really good thing. However, when our mindset is training for competition, that's not an ideal strategy for, we have dozens of other podcasts kind of talking about that, which is that you need to have a plan, know where you're going, and you need to be dictating the tempo and the pace. And striving to an endgame position is a really, really good way to do that. So let's do a thought experiment. And maybe you can, if you're listening to this, you can try it your next several weeks at the gym. This is something that I've been working on, you know, throughout the summer, and I'm going to be sort of shifting as I get ready to compete again. Think of a position that you feel really strong from, a position that you've personally experienced a lot of success in. It could be a conventionally dominant position like the top of mount, or it could be something like the bottom of half guard, for example. Do a quick mental accounting of all the different submission options that are available to you from that position. If it really is a strong position for you, you probably have at least three submissions that you have from that position. Now that you know what that position is, I want you to work backwards from there and think about what are the offensive moves that you can use to get to that position. So for me, if I like the bottom of half guard, maybe an offensive move that I can do to get to that position is to pull half guard from standing, or to, you know, start from the butterfly guard and then move into half guard. When I say offensive, what I mean by that is I wouldn't count that I shrimp out from the bottom of side control and I manage to recover half guard, because the prerequisite for that condition is being in the bottom of side control. We don't want to plan our game plan sort of around that. If we consider those positions our setup positions, then the last step is to think about how you get to your setup positions. So we've kind of broken it into three steps, which is your opening moves that get you to your setup positions, that gets you to your end game position, where you're very likely to get submission victories. So a good example, and one that I used this summer, was I really liked the end game position of the honey hole, or some people call it the 411. Some people call it the saddle. They're not, I guess, technically the same thing, but you know, there's many submissions that are available there, and there's transitions to other really powerful positions like the game over from there. So if my end game position is the honey hole, then in order to get there, I know that if you know someone's standing, I definitely want to attack in the seated guard. If they're in my guard, I want to be in butterfly guard so that I can sort of lift them up, get under their legs, and get to the honey hole. If we're both standing, I'm probably going to want an Imanari roll so that I can get right to the honey hole if the rules permit it. And that's an example of building your entire game around an end game position so that when you roll or when you get ready to compete, you have this sort of single-minded focus with a series of moves and entries and submissions that you have really, really doubled and tripled down on. You'll get to a point after you've practiced it enough where that you know your end game position so well that from virtually any other position in the game of BJJ, you know the best move to get you one step closer to your end game position, and then the next step closer to your end game position. And the fun thing about this experiment is that you can practice this for a couple weeks, practice the end game position of the honey hole, for example. But after that, you can change. You can pick another end game position. And it's a really good way to practice sort of changing up your game and just saying, okay, like, even though this might not be my typical sort of game plan, let's just try this for a month. For 1 month, I'm going to try to get into these leg entanglements and I'm going to become really good at that. And then right when people start figuring out that that's what I want, boom, I'm going to change it up. And then I'm going to go to the back position or something like that. One thing I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast was about tweaking your game to fit into scenarios where endgame positions don't really work, and I didn't really explain that. And this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately because I've been training sort of catch wrestling all around submission grappling during the summer, but as I start getting ready for IBJJF tournaments, endgame positions come up against a problem. The problem is that the IBJJF essentially determines what the endgame positions are because they reward players points for progressing through a series of positions. And it's very clear if you look at the progression, the two positions that IBJJF values the most and awards the most points for is the mount and the back. Which means that if you were competing in an IBJJF rules tournament and your personal endgame that you were striving to get to was something that was not those positions, like, say, the bottom of half guard, then you're running a big risk because you're essentially banking that you're going to be able to submit someone, because otherwise you're ignoring the positional progression that you're supposed to be following. You're not going to score any points for getting to the bottom of half guard. And in fact, you're letting someone get, you know, potentially dangerously close to passing your guard and scoring points of their own. We've talked about before on the High Percentage podcast that our research shows that more matches are decided based on points than on submissions. And depending on the belt level, it's by a fairly significant margin, particularly white belt. Only 1 in 3 matches finish with submissions. At the blue belt level, I think it was about half, maybe a little bit more than half the matches were decided by decision, I believe. I could be wrong on that. Don't quote me. I have to go back and I don't always have all my stats and figures in front of me. This is kind of one of the game theory bummers about the IBJJF setup, which is that it sort of creates an environment where players are more or less pursuing the same thing, which is they understand that they want to get on top, pass guard, and get to the mount, and even if they can, get to the back. And any sort of smart person that is thinking about the game understands that is the plan. Whereas when you get in one of these submission-only matches, you see this huge variety because people don't really care about the positional progression because it doesn't exist, right? There's no points for advancing to position. So your only incentive to advance to position is if it's the position that you like to get you submissions. So you see a tremendous amount of diversity. You see some people that they're really doggedly pursuing those leg entanglement positions, but then you see other people that are trying to pass guard. And this is something that we were watching Polaris 11 a couple weeks ago, and you really saw that with you'd see a player like Nicky Rodriguez, where he really valued kind of takedowns and top control. But then you saw other players that they had absolutely no value for top control. They wanted to sit down to guard and to invert and try to work their game from there. Or you saw Fionn Davis, who, you know, she had a very traditional game where the leg locks were there, but she just didn't value that. It wasn't her in-game position. She wanted to pass guard and get to the more traditionally dominant position. And I think that's really interesting to watch, because when you watch a submission-only match, you see the strategy be much more individualized than in an IBJJF tournament. For me personally, a lot of my end-game positions that I've been practicing a lot on developing this summer are just not going to work in an IBJJF tournament structure, which is I need to tweak it so that I have more of an emphasis on achieving the positions that IBJJF has decided are important, which is passing the guard and getting to the mount or the back. So I'm really going to be double downing on that. But I'm still going to have this in-game theory, which is I'm going to mainly be attacking from the mount because that's the position I like. Now, if you're not training for that kind of tournament and you have the freedom to sort of experiment and choose your in-game positions, one thing I would maybe recommend when you're starting is to not choose the mount or the back as your end-game positions for a couple reasons. One, those are the most difficult positions to achieve, and there's often a fairly linear pathway of how you get to them, which is, you know, if you want to mount someone if you want to mount someone, you know, you really have to become good at guard passing and pass their guard and then be able to, you know, hold them in side control for at least a couple seconds and then mount them. And if your in-game position is the back, you have to do all that, and then you have to take their back. And I know that's not always how it works, but I mean, let's be honest, the majority of times that's sort of the linear progression, and that's hard to do. The second thing that, or reason I wouldn't recommend the mount or the back as endgame positions when you're starting, is that everyone sort of knows that that is by default what you're trying to do, right? So if someone doesn't know a lot about you or your game, they're just going to assume that, of course, you want to pass the guard and get to the mount and take the back until they see something different. What makes endgame positions fun and dangerous is that you can choose a variety of positions, and your opponent won't necessarily know, hopefully, until it's too late. So if your endgame position is a sort of unique, dangerous guard, I don't know, your inverted guard or your reverse De La Hiva guard. What's cool about that is, one, it's very difficult for your opponent to predict, and two, it's very, very easy to get to those endgame positions, right? They don't require hardly any prerequisites other than that you get in the bottom and that you get in someone's open guard or standing guard. As we get ready to wrap this podcast up, the last thing I want to say about endgame theories is that I think they fit really nicely with other game theory concepts that we've talked about on this podcast. One in particular is, there was a podcast where we talked about decision making, and that I think it was the chess podcast, actually, ironically, because we talked about chess earlier in this podcast. But we said that the game of chess is structured in a way that it gives players a lot of time to consider their moves carefully and adjust their strategies accordingly, because they have time. The pace is not real time. It's a turn-based game. And also, they have perfect information. They can see all the board. They can see all the pieces. However, one of the ways that BJJ is very, very, very different than chess is that it doesn't have any of those things, right? We have imperfect information. We don't really know a lot about our opponents. It's not a turn-based game. It's real time. It's also very intense and kinetic, and it happens literally at a faster pace than most humans can make decisions, which lends itself really strong to what we talked about in that podcast, which is something called payoff matrices, which is an idea from game theory that before a game begins, you choose your strategy. You don't choose it during the game while it's happening, because for a game like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, that's not tenable. So having an end game theory is something that works really well with this idea of payoff matrices, which is before the competition starts, you spend weeks or months training for it. You develop your game plan, which is centered around getting to a powerful endgame position. You're sort of hoping and praying that that's going to synergize well with your opponent and that they won't be prepared for your endgame position, which is why it's really useful to pick something that's maybe a little bit less predictable than the mount or the back. And then when the match starts, you know, you kind of either win or you don't. And of course, in the match, things are going to happen that is chaotic and that you can't predict. You might have to change your strategy on the fly, but for the most part, you have this sort of North Star that wherever you are in the match, you know, okay, I want to get to this position. Hey, thanks a lot for listening to this podcast. If you want to keep up with other stuff that we're doing at High Percentage, of course, we have our website, highpercentagemartialarts.com. We try to post content there every week. We don't always hit that, but when we have a lull in content, it's usually because we're working really hard on like a big project, which we have two sort of big projects in the works right now. And they'll be out by the end of this month. Other stuff, if you want to follow stuff that I'm doing personally, I write for a website called grapplinginsider.com. And we have a lot of really good ADCC coverage coming up on Grappling Insider. A lot of big interviews. I'd like to say which ones, but I'm afraid if they get canceled or something, I'll be all embarrassed. But just keep an eye out for that. Once I get those interviews kind of locked in place and they're on the website, I'll make sure to talk about them a little bit on High Percentage. ADCC is only comes around every other year, so it's big. It's basically the Olympics for submission grappling. And it's going to be a really, really great year. Gary Tonin, Nikki Ryan, Gordon Ryan. Sorry, I don't just mean to name everyone from DDS, but you know, everyone that's anyone in competitive grappling is going to be there. And I'll try to have some more content specifically geared towards that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll see you next week on the High Percentage Podcast.